Welcome to episode 138 of Primary Care Update. I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. Friends, family, and longtime listeners know of my love not just for baseball, but specifically the Baltimore Orioles, who are having a resurgence last year and especially this season. My love for the Orioles started when I was about 10 years old. My fifth grade elementary school teacher, Mrs. Hahnstein, allowed us to watch the Orioles play a World Series game against the Dodgers. And it was a life-changing experience for me. And it's with sadness that we note that longtime Orioles great Brooks Robinson died yesterday. He was a multi-year Gold Glove winner, all-star, all-around good guy. And in the 1970 World Series against the Big Red Machine was basically a big human vacuum cleaner that robbed many of a Red of base hits. And so here's to Brooks.
Thanks, Henry. For those of you who are still with us, on this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or POEMS. If you want all of the POEMS, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a POEM every day, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapter and thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. It's been newly revamped. It's pretty cool over there. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are obviously those of the commentators. This podcast does not represent medical advice or endorsement of any product. For a nominal annual fee, you can get CME credit for listening to this podcast from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. Just go to their website, IAFP.com, click on the IAFP education webpage, and find our podcast. This week, we will discuss a deprescribing intervention for older adults in the hospital, medications for managing neuropsych symptoms in adults with dementia, and harms associated with aggressive BP lowering in hospitalized older adults. We kind of have a theme this week. That's unusual for us. I'm going to kick it off talking about this deprescribing intervention. So this one is a little bit convoluted. Stick with me while I describe what they did in this study. They enrolled hospitalized patients 50 years and older who had at least 5 pre-hospital medications and were being discharged to a post-acute care facility. They randomized them to either get what they called the shed meds intervention or usual care. Both groups, this wasn't exactly usual care, both groups got what they called a best possible medication history from either a PharmD, a pharmacist, or a trained nurse practitioner. This best possible medication history. This was a review of medical records, a pharmacy refill history, and then they looked at the controlled substance monitoring database. They also interviewed the patient or their surrogate to obtain this best possible medication history. This is not consistent with my usual practice, I'll just say. The intervention group also got 4 additional steps of this the thorough intervention: a review of medications that could possibly be deprescribed, another conversation with the patient or surrogate about deprescribing. They talked to the outpatient prescribers about the recommendations for possible medications that could possibly be deprescribed, as well as the inpatient team who was caring for the patient in the hospital. And then they followed up with the post-acute care facility after discharge. Following discharge to the post-acute care facility, the research clinician then called the facility on a weekly basis to review the medications and to send a reconciled medication list, ongoing deprescribing recommendations. So they essentially followed these folks as long as they were in the post-acute facility to make sure that the deprescribing recommendations were being followed up. Their primary outcome was the total number of medications at hospital discharge, at PAC facility discharge, and then 90 days after discharge from the post-acute facility. There were 142 patients in each group. They were fairly similar at baseline. Average age was 76. The average median number of medications before they came into the hospital was 16. The median number of hospital medications was 24. So 5 was the threshold for entry. They were on a lot of medications ripe for the deprescribing. The mean number of medications at discharge was similar in the two groups, but at PAC facility discharge, the number was reduced in the people who had this intensive intervention, about 14% fewer overall medications. They also, that phenomenon continued to 90 days post discharge from the PAC facility. The medications that were most frequently deprescribed included vitamins, supplements, laxatives, and antihypertensives. The antihypertensives that they most commonly deprescribed were beta blockers, followed by calcium channel blockers. There were no differences in adverse events, adverse drug events, drug withdrawal events between the two groups. There were a lot of people who, they wound up with a sample size that was about 10% of the number of patients that they approached. But in theory, this was a randomized trial that should have sort of come out in the wash. A few months ago, I think, we talked about a study, it might have been a few years ago, time really has no meaning anymore, where they looked at the what happened to people who go through these deprescribing interventions. And there's a bunch of them. This isn't, you know, the only one that's ever found this. And this was a systematic review that found that somewhere between like 20 and 80% of people who have medications deprescribed go back to them, at least on an as-needed basis. And again, if you're, you know, deprescribing somebody's laxative, they might need it somewhere down the road. But still able to significantly cut back in people who went through this potentially very involved process. Henry, what do you think?
Yeah, so part of that study that you described, the systematic review, not only did it show low rates, mixed rates of resumption, they found minimal harms. And so this is probably, to me, one of the most important places where we can engage and share decision making with our patients. I am incredibly saddened and shocked, Kate, that you don't do best practice medication reconciliation every day on every one of your patients. I mean, I just remember in medical school, we were told we're getting licenses to kill. And the easiest way that we can do that is through the interventions that we foist upon our patients. Seriously, though, this is an important concept. And while we might not need to go through that entire process with all of our patients, certainly in the hospitalized vulnerable, it's probably most critical. There are some resources to help you in this deprescribing process. One of my favorites is MedStopper. They have a tool that helps you with determining frailty. It helps you prioritize which medications. And oh, by the way, if you go to YouTube and type in MedStopper, you will see a really nifty jingle done to the tune of Day Tripper by the Beatles. Also, deprescribing.org has many, many resources. And this, by the way, is endorsed by NIH, National Cancer Institute, the American Academy of Family Physicians, AHRQ, this whole notion of reducing unnecessary medications in our elders is really a central theme. And I actually just went through this with my mom. My 90-year-old mother, she pulled out her drawer full of medications and was loading her little pill bottles, her little pill dispensers. And I kept asking, well, Mom, why do you take this? Well, Cousin Sue said that I should take this. And then there were others. And so, you know, some of the things that she was using were, in fact, many different types of vitamins and supplements that are of dubious quality. But then there were a couple of other things, such as the gemfibrozole and things of that nature, that in a 90-year-old, you start to get some diminishing returns. And so this is an important concept for us to think about. And we can do this with our own loved ones if we're not going to do it for our patients. Gary.
Wow. There's so much stuff that's embedded in this abstract. I'm just shocked. On one hand, I'm shocked. On the other hand, I'm not, that the pre-hospital medication average was 16. And then when they left the hospital, it was 24. If I'm reading this correctly, they had 8 medications added while they were in the hospital.
It was 8 during, eight additional during hospitalization.
During hospitalization. So they came in with 16, but they left with 24. Yeah. I'm going to be talking in a few minutes here about, adding hypertensive medications to elderly patients in the hospital. That shocks me on one hand. On the other hand, when you look at what is regarded as guideline-directed medical therapy, and oh, by the way, you throw in there 3 comorbid conditions, it doesn't surprise me they can get up to 16, right? And then, then we're stuck. You know, are we going to be, you know, basically trying to follow best practices with regards to the GM, guideline direct, GDMT, got that wrong, or are we going to basically, in many ways, not follow that, understanding the patient's specific circumstances. So that's number one. The other issue, too, is that this is a huge intervention for a very little outcome. 15% of the medications were no longer being used at 90 days, and almost all of them were things like what Henry was talking about, multivitamins, vitamin D. I'm glad to see antihypertensives were one of the ones that was also deprescribed. And the third thing is, it's really hard to keep track of this stuff when patients are seeing multiple providers. And, you know, I still wonder whether or not our best strategy for not only understanding what patients are on, but ultimately deprescribing is the paper bag approach. Just bring all your meds into the clinic in a paper bag and let's go through every single one of them. I would wonder whether or not there was a study that looked at that intervention and asked the question, how effective was that in deprescribing, and ultimately were there any patient harms or benefits as a result?
Yeah, I think that certainly just having that good medication history. I work so closely with a clinical pharmacist, and I've now come around to thinking, I don't know how anyone practices good primary care without having a pharmacist that you can call and say, can you, you know, help me out with this patient? And can you, you know, creatinine goes up, creatinine goes down. And now we're working on a pilot to have a pharmacy tech in the office to be able to help us, especially with older adults, especially for inappropriate polypharmacy. Thing I'll say on this before we hand it over to Henry for the quiz a pharmacist once taught me the difference between polypharmacy and inappropriate polypharmacy, right? That some, like you said, some people, you know, to me, that guideline-directed medical therapy, because people do have a lot of chronic comorbidities, some people just need a lot of medication. And if they're, you know, we're not causing harm, they take their medication. It becomes more of an issue when either we are causing harm or when there are medications that they just don't need, or they don't know why they're taking it. We can't figure out why they're taking it. That's inappropriate polypharmacy. And that's really what these studies are targeting. And we owe it all to the pharmacists. All right. Good discussion. Thanks. Henry, we hand it over to you.
All right, so our quiz for this episode asks, which of the following statements about diabetic gastroparesis is true, or is it are true? Sorry. A, symptoms remain stable for more than a decade. B, invasive measures such as surgery, pacemakers, botulinum toxin injections, and so forth are superior to placebo or sham therapies. C, dietary modifications, specifically smaller, more frequent low-fat meals, are superior to control diets. And D, prokinetic agents such as metoclopramide, erythromycin, domperidone, and so forth have been clearly shown to be more effective than placebo. Stay tuned.
All right, you get to just keep rolling, Henry.
Yeah, so my poem comes from the journal Age and Aging. We get both by Wang and colleagues, that asks which medications are most effective in treating the neuropsychiatric symptoms in adults with dementia. So this was a meta-analysis, and they set it up to find all of the best quality studies. They looked at multiple databases for double-blind randomized trials that it compared at least two medications for managing the neuropsychiatric symptoms in adults with dementia. All told, they found 59 studies with nearly 16,000 participants that had 15 different active treatments. And the treatments fell into some large groups like cognitive enhancers, antipsychotics, antidepressants, and mood stabilizers. The participants came from a variety of settings. They had mild to moderate dementia in 40% of the studies. About half were from outpatients, and about 10% were from nursing homes. While nearly all, 86% of the studies were funded by industry, only a quarter of them were considered low risk of bias. In spite of the mediocrity of the data, not only did they pool data, but they did that network meta-analysis thing, the statistical jujitsu, that in hopes that pooling all of this poor quality data will make the data better. That's a fundamental fallacy. Having said that, what did they find? Well, if you looked at overall, and by the way, they were looking at scores, not necessarily specific events. And so it's not clear whether these scores translate well into meaningful differences. And for the most part, they found small effect sizes. So for overall improvement, for example, the standardized mean difference was about 0.2, which really is a small effect size. Risperidone and galantamine were the most effective agents there. looking at aggressive behaviors, they found that piperazole, risperidone, divalproic acid, and olanzapine and memantine were all better than placebo. For looking at psychosis, interestingly, okay, Mark.
You got that for him? I was making a note.
That's the cue, Mark, that you made a mistake, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
All right. Everything's highlighted green. I mean, you know, maybe you need to get a different color.
Yeah, there you go. 3, 2, 1. For reducing psychosis, ironically, donepezil was the most effective agent, followed by haloperidol. And then when you looked at discontinuations and things, galantamine and rivastigmine were nearly twice as likely for patients to discontinue medications. When they tried to look at the balance of benefits and harms, it turns out that risperidone actually had the best balance of effectiveness and adverse effects. Kate, what do you think?
Man, I think this is something that, you know, taking all this data, you know, noting that they mention it's not high quality data, high risk of bias in a lot of them, and sort of taking a look at the overall strength of their results, I think this is something we just really don't know. You know, that none of these medications work very well. And it's a problem that is going to get worse before it gets better. You know, as the population ages, we have more work to do here. We're going to continue giving these medications that have some risk of harm, and we know that because we don't have anything better. And you know, again, as a clinician, I understand that. That's sometimes what we do. But this isn't something that we can say this works when we say risperidone has the best balance of harms and benefits. That we're really saying we can't really say it works very well, and we acknowledge that it has some really specific identifiable risks, but it's of the things that we have tried, it seems to be the thing that works the best. But this isn't something where I would say this is the best medication, because it's really just at the top of a bad pile.
Either everything works or nothing works, right? Yeah. I mean, when you look at this, Henry, there's at least, I mean, I didn't count them directly, but it's at least a dozen different comparisons. Maybe it was 15 that you put down there. And every single one of them, the effect size was small, 0.2. I didn't see anything that had a moderate effect size. So I agree with Kate. I mean, it's just like, you know, at some points you feel like you have to do something, but it almost seems like depending on the circumstance, almost any of these drugs have some effect in terms of mitigating some of the untoward and, you know, adverse effects of dementia, the behavioral effects of dementia.
And we certainly have data from nursing home settings and from hospitalized settings that non-pharmacologic measures, soothing music, lighting, orienting kinds of devices, things of that nature, are more effective than medications in improving some of the adverse behaviors that we're concerned about.
Yeah, it is funny, not funny, but along with what you were just saying, there's a quick text in our EMR at our hospital when patients get in and they have delirium, basically, and it's all of that, you know, basically reassurance. It's, you know, making sure that the patient's sleep-wake cycle is interrupted, you know, making sure they're not constipated. I mean, all some of the simple stuff.
Yeah, and I think that probably works better for, you know, certain kinds of behaviors than it does for, you know, psychosis or things when people are really distressed in certain ways. I worked at a hospital for a while that had a dedicated, you know, geriatrics floor. And one of the things that they would have the patients do when they were a little bit agitated, but not, they gave them a job to do. They would have them fold washcloths, or they would, you know, have them, you know, give them something to do. And that worked incredibly well. Not 100% of the time, not for every patient, but, you know, and there would be an aide in there, you know, undoing those washcloths as fast as the patients could fold them so they could fold them again. But again, you know, reduce the rate of medication use. It actually was turned out to be cost effective in terms of the aide's time as well.
Kate, that's brilliant. Has that been systematically studied? What an interesting idea.
No idea. And again, it had to be a really carefully chosen couple of patients. But yeah, just
yeah, how interesting.
All right, Gary, over to you.
All righty. So this is published in May, JAMA Internal Medicine. It's entitled "The Clinical Outcomes of Intensive Inpatient." I want to underline that, inpatient blood pressure management in hospitalized older adults. So this was a retrospective study, so proving association potentially, not causation. So just keep that in mind. But this is one of many, many, many studies I've looked at. We do our CME courses. I typically am in charge of looking at blood pressure. And there have been dozens of studies, perhaps, that have looked at inpatient management of hypertension and what are we actually accomplishing. So this is yet another data point in that premise. So they looked at the VA health system. They looked at older adults who are defined as 65 or older, who on admission had two or more elevated blood pressures within the first 48 hours of hospitalization. They had a 66,000 N in terms of their N. They tried to exclude patients who were hospitalized for cardiovascular disease and also those who came in with hypertensive emergencies. And then they asked the question, if that early elevated blood pressure was managed, I'll talk about management in a minute, did it make a difference in terms of any of the outcomes? Just a quick point here, it does, but it's not in the beneficial direction. So what happened is within 48 hours of admission, 21% of the cohort had that elevated blood pressure managed with either new oral medications or new intravenous medications to lower the blood pressure. The other basically 79% didn't have it managed, so they compared the two groups. So they asked the question, what happened to the two groups? Their outcome was pretty robust. It was death, stroke, acute kidney injury, elevated troponins, elevated BNP, or transfer to the intensive care unit, and there was a few other in there as well. So things that are pretty easy to measure and obviously important for the patient. And they also looked at a bunch of groups based upon age, elevation of the blood pressure, gender, and I think a few other covariates as well. What they found here was, and this is kind of important, that the risk of an adverse outcome was about 2% absolute risk elevation, 2% higher in those who were treated versus those who weren't. So an N and H, if I'm doing my math correctly, of about 50 or so. And they looked at this also in terms of some of the subgroups, and they found that there was really no difference, except with one, which I'll talk about in a minute. But they looked at age, fragility, elevated outpatient blood pressure, whether they had a history of cardiovascular disease. Remember, if they came in for a cardiovascular reason, they were excluded. The only group in which the early treatment for elevated blood pressure did not was not associated with harm, that's probably a better way to put it, was those who were they called a severe elevation, whether that's a blood pressure elevation of 180 or greater within the first 48 hours of hospitalization. In addition, and again, this is intuitively, I think, obvious, patients who had their blood pressure managed with intravenous medications had a worse outcome than those who had it managed with oral medications. So again, this is, and it's hard as a, I still do some hospital work, mostly, supervising the residents, and you get a call from the floor, the patient's blood pressure is 160. It's hard not to respond to that. And so long story short, it is one of those things that I think is not been highly associated with beneficial outcomes. There's a lot of observational studies suggesting harm when we treat inpatient blood pressure aggressively. And these authors, among many others, have started to talk about, we really need to have randomized controlled trials to give us a definitive answer.
Yeah, interesting study. I think this is similar to one that was done a couple of years ago that I remember, I think it was you talking about, where they looked at the outpatient outcomes. So people who had blood pressure medications started in this same situation, they were in the hospital, they had elevated blood pressures, medications were started, and it essentially started the same thing, that they did worse in terms of these same kind of cardiovascular and mortality outcomes if they had those medications started in the inpatient setting. And I think just like we're finding in the outpatient setting, it's just not best to diagnose somebody with high blood pressure when they're acutely ill, when they're in this sort of critical setting, or even when they just come in to see the doctor. Apparently, we stress them out. And that's just not when their blood pressure is most likely to reflect what it really is. And so using those sort of out of office or out of hospital readings is probably.
And tying this back into your abstract, Kate, this was one of the key classes of medications that people left the hospital with that were ultimately deprescribed. So this may be a sweet spot for deprescribing, basically. When patients leave the hospital, they come back for outpatient follow-up.
Right. The other thing I'll say about this is that even in patients who have had a new stroke, so they come in, we've diagnosed them with the stroke, the recommendation, not only do we have some permissive hypertension in that case, but also when they're ready to restart their medications, the recommendation is to restart their home blood pressure medications orally. So even, you know, in sort of the case where they do come in with an acute, you know, cardiovascular, cerebral vascular event, the recommendations generally are to treat it as you would, but not to treat it aggressively, not to sort of treat to, you know, in the old school days, put them on a drip and, you know, try and titrate it to, but just to restart it. So manage it, but not manage it overly aggressively, because it seems to be associated with worse outcomes. So Henry, what do you think?
Yeah. So Gary, my response often when I would get the call from the nurse about a blood pressure or something like that was, thank you. And occasionally it would be, let's just repeat it, because quite often you get that regression to the mean phenomenon and just repeated blood pressures will come down by themselves. As you pointed out, there were many confounders in this study that are not amenable to statistical manipulation. And I think that's an important consideration. And the randomized trials that you called out for would help to overcome many of those limitations. This is not a new theme, by the way, not just about blood pressure, but many things that, you know, we know that X, Y, and Z are often associated with bad outcomes, right? Elevated blood sugars in the ICU patients are associated with bad outcomes. We have electrolyte disruptions, things of that nature that are all associated with bad outcomes. Most of the time when we find that we manipulate these, that there is no real benefit. And so our residents would periodically had a patient who came in with hyperkalemia and you see KXLate has been added to their medication list without necessarily stepping back and asking why is the potassium or why is the calcium elevated. So this whole notion of thinking about why the phenomenon is present is an important consideration. And so the first thing that I'd like to think about is, let's step back and bring back some wisdom, if you will, that phronesis that we talked about, I think it was last episode, is, first of all, is the alteration in the parameter within just sort of statistical variation. Second is whether or not this is a physiologic response, a normal compensatory response, or is it pathologic? And especially like post-stroke with blood pressure, as Kate alluded to, you know, quite often we need to keep our hands off for a little while. And so I think this notion of knee-jerk responses, we somehow need to add in some delaying tactics to, especially to learners.
Great. Another interesting study, good discussion. Henry, give us the answer to today's quiz.
Oh, yeah. So which of the following statements about diabetic gastroparesis is true? A, symptoms remain stable for more than a decade. B, invasive measures are superior to placebo or sham therapies. C, dietary modification are superior to control diets. And D, prokinetic agents have been clearly shown to be more effective than placebo. My source for this answer comes from an essential evidence topic. While nearly half of patients with diabetes are found to have ultrasonic evidence of gastroparesis, only 10% or so actually have symptoms. In a small longitudinal study of adults with gastroparesis and either type 1 or type 2 diabetes, after 12 years of follow-up, there was no difference in any objective measures of gastric emptying or in symptom severity scores. And oh, by the way, their mean baseline A1C was 8.4, and over that 12 years of follow-up, they decreased to 7.6. So improved glycemic control didn't really make any difference in this regard either. In randomized trials, invasive measures have not been shown to be effective. And while dietary modification is recommended by the most recent American Gastroenterological Association guideline as initial therapy, it's purely based on expert opinion and they provide no data whatsoever. So finally, we have a recent network meta-analysis that basically found that the evidence on the effectiveness of prokinetic agents was pretty poor. So the correct answer is A, the symptoms can remain stable for at least a decade.
Very interesting. Thank
Who'd
you.
Have known?
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening today. Again, the website for obtaining CME credit is iafp.com. Then look for the online IAFP education webpage. The Illinois Academy of Family physicians would like you to know that they are accredited by the ACCME to provide CME credit for physicians. The IAFP designates this podcast for 0.5 AMA Category 1 credits. The IAFP adheres to the conflict of interest policy of the ACCME and the AMA. You can read our complete disclosures on the IAFP website. Let us know if you do that. We hope you all have enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends. Speaking of friends, Mark is on vacation. We hope he's having a great time. We hope he is wearing his helmet. We hope he's having a delicious worst for us since we are not there. We will talk to you soon with more primary care updates.